hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
welcome to The Lynn Show, coming to you, as always, on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Radio Ear Network. And if you have been listening, then you know I often talk too much at the beginning of the show, and then I don't get to do everything I want to do. So I'm going to say as quickly as possible that as a psychotherapist, I wrote this book called When You Can, You Will, and I've been making my way through it. Its intent is to help you understand that if there's something that you want to do that you haven't been able to do, that there's a really good reason. And the book delineates, explains many of those reasons, and I've been working my way through that. So if this is of interest to you, then the first half of the show is going to be about what I call catastrophic expectations. I've been talking in the last few shows about the possibility that there's a danger that would make itself known to you if you made this change you've been unable to make. And one of the dangers is what I have labeled catastrophic expectations, anticipation of disaster. In this show, I'm going to talk about two of those catastrophic expectations. The second half of the show, I've been dedicating to a series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist. In the second half of this show, I was fortunate enough to interview world-famous musician Dick Hyman. I'm not going to tell you all of what he has done because that's what the interview will say. And that interview is followed with an interview with his remarkably talented sculptor wife, Julia Hyman. So those interviews will be played in this show, and I'm going to close the show with a cut from a CD that Dick gave me. The CD is called In Recital, and it's all solo piano, and all of the songs are amazing examples of what it's like to be a virtuoso pianist. But the song I'm choosing to close the show with is the only one on the album that Dick actually wrote. It's called Thinking About Bix. And hopefully when I play the couple session, and maybe that'll be next week, I'll play another cut from the CD. But before I play the CDs, as promised, I'm going to talk about catastrophic expectations. I'm going to talk about two of the most popular, most common catastrophic expectations, ones that have stopped most of us from doing something at some time in our lives. The catastrophic expectation of failure and the less well-known catastrophic expectation of success. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the most common catastrophic expectation, fear of failure, which of course has stopped all of us at one time or another from trying to do something that we wanted to do. Even though it's often necessary to fail before you can succeed, our culture applauds success and disparages failure. Everyone knows it's better to succeed than to fail, right? Well, of course, that's wrong. There are lessons that can only be learned from failure. There's a wonderful Mark Twain quote, which I'm not going to get exactly right. It is, one learns a lesson by holding a cat by its tail that one can learn in no other way. And of course, that's right. There are lessons that can only be learned from failure. And perhaps the most important lesson that can be learned from failure is that you can survive it. I can't make this point strongly enough, and in fact, I will probably make it over and over again, and that is that knowing that we can endure, knowing that we can survive, is what makes change possible, whatever our obstacle is. Knowing that we can survive the thing we're afraid of, the danger our unconscious anticipates, our worst fear or our catastrophic expectation. It is knowing that we will survive that that makes it possible to take the risks. So, some people who start right out succeeding and consequently have no experience of failure are often incapacitated later in life by the mere suggestion that they might fail. The hint that they might fail is their catastrophic expectation. Now, in addition to the cultural pressure that we all have to succeed, because we all know it's better to succeed than fail, and we're going to get a gold star for succeeding and something not so hot for failing, there are also personal reasons for strenuously avoiding failure. For some people, failure has become linked with loss of love. Many parents, in a mistaken effort to encourage their children, punish them for failing, or only reward them when they succeed. You know the story of, oh, you got 98, what happened to the other two? This is the kind of parenting, however, which teaches children that the price for failure is loss of love. None of us can afford to pay that price. And so for those of us who believe that failure will cost them love, even thinking about a change that might end in failure can be too big a risk. Between the cultural and the personal pressure to succeed, many people are just incapacitated by the prospect of failure, unable to do things they really want to do simply because they're afraid that they may fail. And so failure, a huge catastrophic expectation. I want to tell you about a client of mine named Fran, who came to me because she'd been dating Rick for 2 years. She knew that she loved him. She thought she wanted to marry him, but somehow she wasn't able to take that step. She couldn't move, you know. When I asked Fran the what would happen if question, you know, what would happen if she married Rick, she said she'd feel safer, her life would be more settled, then they wouldn't be paying two rents. She had lots of good reasons for marrying Rick. And then, sort of like a light bulb went off, she said, well, you know, I don't want to fail at this marriage, too. Fran had been married twice before. This would be her third marriage, and she was afraid of being, to use her words, a three-time loser. But almost as soon as she had that thought and said those words, you could see that that thought was beginning to fail, and she was going into denial for that catastrophic expectation. And she gave a little laugh, and she said, oh, well, I'm sure that it's okay. You know, it'll be all right. But what if it's not all right? What if it is another failure? Before Fran could marry Rick, she had to know that even if it was another failure, even if she experienced her worst catastrophic expectation, she would survive. And she would not endure too great a loss of self-esteem. So until then, her mouth could keep saying, it'll be okay. But her unconscious couldn't make it say, I do. Okay, so we all know the power of fear of failure and how that can get in the way of things that we want to try. An equally powerful, if less acknowledged, obstacle to change is fear of success. People will talk a lot about it, oh, I must be afraid of success and all that, but they won't think seriously about what it means, what the price of success might be, what the cost might be. And of course, it's the cost, the price that we're afraid will come due, that's getting between us and trying for things. Success can have catastrophic expectations because it can have unexpectedly dangerous or unpleasant side effects. Just like with failure, the price of success can often be loss of love. You know, you've all heard the sayings, don't get a swelled head, you're too big for your britches, who do you think you are? Well, those kinds of responses make people afraid to aspire to or actually achieve success. In the early shows, when I talked a lot about the family, the impact that the family can have on our ability to do things later in life, you know, our family of origin. I also talked a lot about family balance, called homeostasis. The family must achieve balance. So, oh, you know, if you want to know more about those things, you can listen to the podcasts. It's all indicated what I'm talking about in any given show. But for now, you just have to take my word for it that families require balance. And if the balance of your family, either your family of origin or your current family, and that can also mean your friends, your colleagues, etc. If the balance of any family that's important to you is upset by you or any member becoming too successful, then success can bring scorn, criticism, jealousy, ostracism. When success is your danger, you're doubly bound. You're bound by the expected pain of failure and the expected cost of success. Brenda, another client of mine, was 41 years old, and she'd raised her children, and she wanted to go back to work. She'd worked for many, many years before her marriage, and she was sure that she could easily get a job and that she would really like working. She was competent, she was qualified, she was encouraged by her husband and her children. Still, she couldn't make herself take the first step towards finding a job. She couldn't remember what she did with the newspaper, and then when she circled things, she'd lose them, and then she'd forget to make telephone calls, and she couldn't make herself work on her resume. And this didn't make any sense because Brenda was very, very efficient in all the areas of her life. It took her a long time to recognize what her catastrophic expectation was. Because, as I said, she was getting encouragement from everywhere. Everybody would say, and she thought, you know, you'll have an identity outside that of mommy, you'll have extra money, you'll have a more meaning to your life. You know, there were no downsides. Until she realized that although her husband was encouraging her, she believed that her husband wouldn't like having a working wife. She said, again, sort of in passing, you know, we're married a long time, and a lot of our friends, couples also married a long time, are getting divorced. And my husband, he's used to a stay-at-home wife, and I'm not sure, I don't know if he'd like it. I mean, suppose he wanted to go on vacation and I couldn't get a vacation from my job. Well, Brenda wanted to work, but as long as she believed that her success at getting a job might cost her her marriage, well, that was too big a price to pay. And so, of course, her unconscious was stopping her from looking for a job. If you've been listening to what I've been talking about and you're beginning to consider the possibility that there may be a danger, admittedly an unrecognized danger, or what I'm calling a catastrophic expectation, that's stopping you from doing what you want to do, one of the ways to find out what that is to ask yourself the what would happen if question. Now, that's an exercise that I explain in detail in an earlier show. And again, if you go up on thelynnshow.com, it's L-Y-N-N-E, you can find that podcast and hear in detail how you ask yourself the what would happen if question and do that exercise. But if you do it, you may get a fleeting glimpse of your catastrophic expectation. And then, because you're a product of your culture, you may say things to yourself like, well, that's no big deal, that shouldn't stop me. Or even, well, hell, so I'm afraid, I should push through my fear. And you might get a lot of support for that from friends. But for just a moment, trust yourself. Allow yourself to consider the fact that you really are afraid of what might happen when you make the change you've been avoiding, and that however trivial it might seem to you or your friends at this moment, the catastrophic expectation that's stopping you is the reason you haven't been able to change, and that it's a really valid reason. Catastrophic expectations are only one of the kinds of dangers that you could be protecting yourself from. There are many, many dangers. Actually, they're person-specific. What's stopping you may just be true for you and almost nobody else. But the better you understand the nature of the danger that you may be afraid to face, the better prepared that you will be to deal with it. In the next show, I'm going to talk about future dangers, and if I have enough time, I'm going to talk about past dangers. If you are interested in learning more about When You Can, You Will, the book, the workbook, or the audiobook are all available at my website, which is www.thelynshow.com. And Lynn is spelled with an E. So it's thelynneshow.com. On that website, you can find more information about the book, how to get the book, which is, by the way, limited edition. So if you are interested in it, please let me know as soon as possible, the workbook or the audiobook. Also, the songs that I play at the beginning and the end of this show, and sometimes during the show, although I haven't done it in quite a long time, are from my CD, which is to say that I wrote the songs and then I'm singing them. And the CD is also available on the website, and if you click on the little CD icon, it takes you to CD Baby, which is an internet music store, and you can listen to pieces of all of the cuts and decide if you want to own it. Also, there's an article that I wrote about phone psychotherapy, which is what I'm doing these days, and there's information about me as a therapist and as a consultant, as a songwriter, as a radio show host. Just lots of stuff about me if you are curious about any of that. It's all on the website. If you just wanted to email me and you didn't want to go through the website, you could email me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com. And I like to say in every show that none of these shows would be possible without the intelligence and capability and diligence and kindness of Josh Hackney, who is my guru and who makes all things here possible. In the last few shows, I've been telling you that if you go up on my website and you write to me or write to my email and you say, get me in touch with Josh, I will. But in this show, I'm actually going to give you Josh's information. You can call him at 941-320-7590, or you can email him at josh, the letter C, hackney, at yahoo.com. If you have any recording, website, internet, IT needs, Josh is the guy. And now, here's my interview with Dick Hyman. I'm sitting here with Dick Hyman. I was trying to think of adjectives for you, Dick, but I couldn't think of anything.
Oh, you don't need adjectives. You need descriptives.
Okay.
So I'm a pianist and composer these days. Occasionally conductor, less and less a concert producer, and formerly an organist. How's that?
And a kind and generous man.
Well, that's not for me to say.
No, I'll say that.
Okay.
This is very generous of you. I know how busy you are. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
I don't have an agenda for these interviews. I don't have questions particularly. What I'm mostly interested in is what you would want to say about what it means to have spent a lifetime being an artist, something not that many people can pull off in this culture.
Well, that's all I know. That's all I've done is to try to be an artist. But of course, you can't just be an artist. You can't just create stuff. It's not. You have to do it for a purpose. And, oh, look at that black snake there.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I know that he or they are underneath this thing.
Wow.
They're harmless, though.
We're at Dick's house, and he is pointing to his lanai, where there is a slithering black snake going under the what?
Under the deck.
Under the deck, right.
Well, they can't go under the house, but under the deck.
Do they get in the pool?
That's happened, yeah.
But that surprises Junior.
Well, it hasn't happened that dramatically. So I was saying that it's one thing to be an artist and try to create stuff, but you have to do it for an audience or for other artists or for something, and that requires a degree of socialization and organization that not everybody is prepared to accept at the very beginning.
So were you at the very beginning?
Yeah, because with me and with most artists, it tied in with making a living, too. Mm-hmm. I made a living at it.
What is the very beginning for you?
The very beginning was playing the piano, exploring the keyboard, getting instruction on it from my big brother, who was very facile in playing and who showed me the elements of the keyboard, and my uncle, who was a concert pianist, and again, my brother, who brought home recordings of jazz classics, which indelibly imprinted me with much of the material I've used since. That was the beginning. And then in school, we formed ourselves into little kid bands and played dances. Same thing went on in college, and really the same thing went on after college. Largely, I was still becoming parts of bands and playing for dancing and for the college radio station. And everything was a segue, as we say in music. Everything followed. There wasn't any great change from playing for high school dances, playing for grown-up dances with a grown-up band later on, and playing for the college radio station and playing for public radio stations thereafter, and that's how it went.
So you always knew?
Yeah, I always knew. I was always playing the piano, always trying to, as I see it now, interact with other people through music.
So that came naturally to you, the desire to interact with other people through music?
Yes, it did. It seemed perfectly natural. I really wouldn't have known any other way to go.
So was it all right with your family that you were going to be a musician?
My family was, as I look back on it, unexpectedly supportive. They really were fine about it. And we had a musician in the family, my mother's brother, my uncle. There was no attempt to make me into any other professional person, and it just all seemed to flow naturally. The only thing they insisted on was that I finish college and not go out on the road as I might have in my early teens. They were right about that, of course. I probably would never have gone back to college if I had left. So that was the only thing. They supported it. They supported an early marriage to Julia, which still survives. And I think they did that as a means of...
Anchoring you.
Pardon?
Anchoring you.
That's a good word. I was looking for the right word. Yeah, not going crazy with the guys. So I've had a relatively
moderate and wild life.
even as a jazz musician, even as a bebopper, which I was for a while, or as a Dixieland musician, which I was for a while.
So you weren't seduced?
No, I found early on that I didn't have to drink, I didn't have to smoke pot. The other guys would respect that because I played well.
Yes.
It was that easy.
Yeah, right. They wanted you, so. So you started playing, how old were you when you started playing?
Oh, I imagine I was 9 or 10 or something like that.
Yeah, so you fell in love with it very young.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think falling in love is quite the term. I was completely empathetic with it.
Apathetic with it?
Empathetic.
Oh, empathetic. Thinking.
Yeah.
Empathetic, meaning that...
I mean, it just seemed the natural thing to do.
I think that a lot of people feel that for one form of art or another, but they don't have your experience of it flowing so naturally into something that you can make a living at.
Well, for one thing, I think I was fortunate that I could start early. I have heard of professional musicians who started in their teens later on, and even later, and have made it, but I think that's the hard way. In a way, I wish I had started with rigorous technical practice early on as well. I had to get to that a little bit later, but I don't think you can become a virtuoso of the highest order, such as the young Asian people we see so many of now, without having started Suzuki lessons at the age of 3.
You said that you thought it was a good thing that your parents encouraged you to finish college and that you would not have gone back.
Yeah.
So what did you get there that you think is valuable?
Well, I went to Columbia in New York, and they emphasized the humanities and becoming educationally rounded. So I had a smattering acquaintance with the great books and the great trends in history and so forth and so on. I think that was good.
Yeah, so it was information and cultural exposure.
It was the idea that you should be aware of what's happening and what has happened. Not that that education there was anywhere near complete, but it gave me a point of view, which I'm trying to follow up on.
And did you study music there?
Well, I studied music in Colombia as far as I could, which was just as a major as part of a humanities degree. That is to say, a history of music, some counterpoint, a class in composition, and so forth. For one term, I doubled at Juilliard and studied orchestration there. That was useful. However, none of these things in music was as important as the practical on-the-job training I got thereafter, or as the couple of extracurricular things I did in college, playing on the campus radio station, playing in the campus dance band, or taking, oh yes, this is one very good course. I took a course in chamber music, and I learned a couple of things. I wish I had more of a repertory there, but at least I've been able to play something from the chamber music repertoire.
You're really all over the map anyway, musically.
Yeah, I've been known as...
Everything.
Yeah, I've been known as the chameleon, largely because that was the nature of Woody Allen's character in Zelig. He was the chameleon. It's a name that stuck to me in the business.
So actually, talk about that a little bit, because not everybody who's listening will know.
No, of course. I got to be involved with Woody Allen, first as a sideman, playing in various pickup orchestras for a recording of his films. And then I gradually got to be the composer he called on when needed. To sum up, I arranged and composed and played and directed the music for 10, 11, 12 films or so. And of course, films are always with you. They're always seen and revived. You have satisfying credits on the end of them. But really, that was just part of the general scene. I had two things going in those days. I was a jazz guy on the one hand, and I was a very active studio player. What that meant was that you were available to play anything that anybody wanted at sight. That's just about what it was. And we did that constantly. It was a golden age of that sort of recording, and we recorded films and commercials and pop records, occasionally jazz records, and radio programs. And I'm old enough to have been there at the inception of television broadcasting, and we did that too. And I was on staff at NBC for 5 years in that sort of role. And then from piano and organ playing, I began inevitably to be an arranger and a conductor, because that comes naturally out of that background.
And the composing?
The composing, for me, has come about from the fact that I'm constantly composing as a jazz player. That's what we do.
Yeah, right.
We improvise all the time. We're not just freely improvising. We're improvising according to certain specifications. I use that as the basis for my composing. For better or for worse, that's where it comes from with me.
That you discovered, figured out, that what you were doing as a jazz player...
Yeah, it's the same source. Let's put it this way. Formal composing has a couple of fail-safe provisions. You can do it over, and every time you do it over, it's better, I've found. Being a jazz player is marvelous, but you have only one shot at it until the next time. But it's the same process. Composing means you can organize things much better. You can change the beginning, the ending, the middle, suddenly see a relationship between two things that you have been working with, and put them together, take them apart. You have the chance to ruminate over the whole thing. The jazz process is of the moment, and of course, it's much less organized and less verbal and wonderful in that respect. Composing allows you to, I hope, to take that and organize it a little better so that other people can play it also, in collection or solo.
The jazz thing is completely spontaneous.
Well, yes, it is completely spontaneous. It isn't what some people assume, that it's completely freshly inventive all the time. It isn't quite that. You get into certain patterns, and you have to make decisions as to whether you want to do this pattern or that pattern or no pattern, which is really the most interesting exploratory part of it.
Yeah, but then, as you say, it goes by and it's over.
Yes.
And
unlike Julia's work, where she has to really plan a thing. She has a certain amount of improvisation at the beginning in deciding what she's doing, or perhaps when the stone, sometimes by breaking, determines how she will finish her sculpture. But her process is much more fixed than a musician's is. She's stuck pretty much with what she started to do, whereas we can decide all kinds of things, including just abandoning it. It's not nearly so much of a problem to abandon a song as it is to abandon a 100-pound piece of stone.
Now, it occurs to me that what Julia does is literally in stone.
Yeah, it literally is in stone, whereas we pride ourselves in not having any.
Well, and the other thing about something that you compose is that you can take a piece of it and use it somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, and I often do that.
So that you might abandon this whole, but you might have things that you can salvage from it that you use other places.
Well, this is true. And you do this even without thinking about it. Things that you have worked on and abandoned without your intention might show up in another thing because you've been there already.
Yeah, your unconscious has not forgotten it.
Exactly.
I'm curious, is there a favorite activity for you?
Yes, these days it's composing. I still continue to play, and I run around doing concerts very happily, but I'm doing what I think is the right thing for this age, which is getting pretty advanced. I'm staying home and writing more.
How old are you, do you mind?
I'm 81.
You were just, right, in March?
Yeah.
You and I share the same astrological sign.
You're a Piscean?
I am.
Ah.
And one of the things about this sign, I think, that we like to do a lot of different things, so that even within the context of music, you do a lot of different things.
Oh, yeah, I do. I think I'm known for that.
Yes, and unlike some other Pisceans, you do all of them extremely well.
Well, I try.
I think that's incredibly clear, that that's really important to you. That, anyway, what's coming across to me is this desire to do it as well as you can do it, and maybe even as well as it can be done.
That's, of course, the goal. You have to settle for something less than perfection, of course.
But you're aiming.
Yeah.
Yeah, not everybody's aiming.
Hmm.
This has been really interesting and informative for me, and I'm wondering, will you take a second to think about what, if there was anything that you would want to say about what it means to be an artist, maybe what it means to be a musician, what it means to be an artist in this culture that we live in that's not particularly encouraging to artists, anything that you would want to say, I would like to hear.
I'm not going to say that this culture is not encouraging to artists. In my own experience, I've been very encouraged.
Yes.
But, of course, I've dealt with mainly with accessible and popular music. If I had decided to become a 12-tone composer early on, I can see that I wouldn't have that impression. No, I think that you have to meet the culture.
Do you remember doing that consciously? Or was it just that you were drawn, that you are your culture, and so you were drawn to the things that your culture wanted? Do you know what I'm asking?
You're asking why I didn't become a 12-tone serial composer.
In a way, yeah.
As a teenager, it would have seemed silly to me. I knew nobody else who was doing that. I didn't like it when I heard it. I still don't care for it. So the alternatives to doing what I did, considering my background, were not present. That's what I do.
So in a way you were lucky to be drawn to what was also what would also want you.
Well, yeah. Not that there didn't have to be choices made. I mean, one, from my background, one could have gone into musical comedy, writing Broadway shows, writing film, writing altogether instead of, as I did, partially.
Pop songs.
Pop songs, all that, yeah. There are a lot of ways to have gone, and I have many friends, and I know lots of people who didn't specialize in one thing or other. I don't know. You go where your tendencies lead you, but then you want to have a broad idea of what the possibilities are, too. Sometimes you can get led by very trivial things like a phone call.
Are you thinking of something in particular?
No, I'm thinking of Sammy Kahn, the lyric writer. They asked him the old question of which comes first, the music or the lyrics, and he said, first comes the phone call.
Yeah, right. That's a professional musician.
Yeah.
Speaking.
Yeah. The phone call comes, and what you mean by that is that living in a society is important. It's what I started to say to begin with. It's not just a personal diary or meditations that won't be discovered for 200 years. You're part of the culture.
And I do think that that's significant, that if you can continue to see yourself as part of the culture, then you don't see the culture as the enemy.
No, not that there haven't been trends within my little specialties that I didn't approve of, but they come and go.
Like what?
Well, I really haven't been a part of pop music for a long time because it went in directions that didn't seem to be a part of my background. On the other hand, I have done a couple of rap things. So it's true.
Have you?
Yes, I have. Some of my things have been made into rap records. Some rappers like the backgrounds. Busta Rhymes, I'm proud to say, liked the background of one of my synthesizer records, and he used it for something. And I never met him, but we've been great collaborators on that one piece.
So you continue to be a part of your culture?
Well, I suppose so, now that you think of it. From all the rap music about 10 years ago, I made some pieces for piano. I call it just that, 3 raps for piano. Played them in concert just the other night. So I understand that. But in general, I've come to see that my one's period in music and possibly in art is what you came up with.
You mean grew up with?
What you grew up with. Up through perhaps the age of 50, you know that stuff very, very well. And after that, it becomes a little bewildering.
And you've been really able to to stay current.
Well, I still stayed current until a relatively short time ago, but I'm not sure I want to bother now.
Yeah, but that's an entirely different thing that you might not want to bother.
I find I have enough to use in my composing.
Yes.
I don't have to say au courant for every little wrinkle that comes up. I have plenty to work on, and that's what I'm doing.
And what are you composing these days?
Well, I've just finished a second string quartet, which will be premiered in the fall. And last December, I believe it was, we did a trio for piano, violin, and cello. These are in classical venues, but I'm writing what I want to write. So there's plenty of jazz in it, and the trio has some rock quotes in it, which amuse me.
You are wonderful.
You're not supposed to say that.
I'm not?
No.
Who's supposed to say that?
My wife.
I'm quite sure we can get her to say that as well. This was so generous of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shall we get Julie?
And in fact, we did get Julie, and this is her interview coming up. I'm sitting here with Julia Hyman in her kitchen. And Julia is a sculptor. Well, Julia is a lot of things. Currently, did you start sculpting young?
I was always sculpting, mostly in clay, as I worked. And I worked as a decorator for 33 years, an interior designer.
So tell me how you started sculpting.
It really started when my children were very little. Someone came to Tenafly, where we lived, who was teaching a course in carving. And he showed me how to carve soft stone. And I flipped out. And I thought, if I could have a life like that, that would be wonderful. But I didn't think it was possible.
Yeah.
And that grew into working with somebody named Marilyn Fox. I worked in clay and learned how to build forms and fire them so that I could almost create new sculptures, but in clay. And then I worked at the Art Students League, took a small sabbatical 1 year from work, and I worked with Jose de Kreft, and he taught me a lot.
You were an interior decorator for 33 years, is that
yes,
what you said?
Yes, specializing in house renovation and commercial spaces.
What does that mean?
It means going in and putting in new kitchens and maybe reconfiguring a house and bathrooms and surfaces. And if I were doing that work, I also bought the furniture. I designed the space. But I would go in and just do the renovations. I had a nice crew, and I liked it.
Yeah, no, and it's just another art form.
I realize that now. But I really liked it, and what it led me into, along with the decorating, is speculating in real estate and renovating it.
Ah, very smart.
So I also learned how to be a landlady.
And a businesswoman.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And again, well, not again, but those skills don't always arrive in the same person. You know, the capacity to create art, the desire to create art, and the ability to be a business person along with it?
Well, the business part was a necessity, because if you're going to be contracting people to do the work and you have to pay them and you have to collect the money, you're in business. But what I have learned is that my decorating or renovating, both, has really led me into the sculpture, because I see sculpture as I see space.
Yes.
And it's really much the same thing.
Will you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'd say it all started when I was a little kid and I liked to do jigsaw puzzles.
Yeah, I talk about that.
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. I remember when I'd get sick, my father would bring home 3 and 4 from the city, and I just as soon stay sick and make jigsaw puzzles. And decorating or renovating, both, are jigsaw puzzles.
Yes.
Because the pieces have to fit.
So it's about that for you, how these things go together correctly.
And same with the stone and the wood. I do multiple shapes, 2 or 3 that fit together. They may not fit as a jigsaw puzzle, but they work together, or they're of the right materials together. I really know now that it's the same thing.
It's the same thing over and over again.
It's a translation.
It's
a translation.
Yes. This is really interesting to me, because this is not a concept I have ever thought of before. But in the way that some people are drawn to music or to dance, you got drawn to space, shapes, design.
Well, I have to tell you something funny.
Yeah?
Because it just dawned on me when my grandson called and he said he was going to major in furniture design. And I remembered that my grandfather and my uncles and my father were in the furniture business.
Yes.
And there I am designing furniture and things like furniture, cabinetry and stuff. And now he's doing it. So I have a feeling there's some visual gene that takes place where we see things in the round. Not like painters who see in 2 dimensions. I see everything from all sides at all times. And I just recently did a renovation for Dick and myself, and I realized that I was visualizing the whole house as a piece. As remember when we had doll houses as kids? You could see in them. Well, that's how I
and
was
dioramas.
Doing it. I didn't have to. It was all in my head, and I was seeing the house as of a piece. So it's some little quirky thing in the genetic makeup.
I'm really fascinated with it, and I mean my own tendency would be to say, you know, did you get this from a relative? You know, did people talk about this? Did your mother or father or no? You're shaking.
Well,
your head.
They talked about wallpaper and things like that, but before I was even married and I was going off to school, my folks decided to sell the house and move to an apartment. And I designed the closetry and worked with the carpenters, and I was all 17 years old.
So it was really
it was always there. It was always there.
And the other interesting thing about this is that it was so much a part of you. It's integral, really. It's almost cellular. So you had to come a far way before you could see how integral it is to you.
Yeah. I just thought that everybody could do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know that I truly respected what it was that I was doing from the point of view of a skill that other people didn't have. I mean, I realized that my clients couldn't do it, but I figured out that maybe they couldn't do it because they just weren't shown. And in some cases, my clients became decorators. And then I designed a course for the new school, the Parsons School of Design. I took people through the process, people who wanted to do their own homes. And we met, we had 12 students, and we met in 12 homes in each term.
Wow.
And I guided the group through the decorating of the homeowner of the moment.
And did they get it?
They got a lot, and I encouraged them to shop together.
This is really interesting, because it is really a question of whether it's gettable or whether, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I think that you have to also have the desire to be in business.
Well, I'm not thinking about the business aspect of it. I'm
just
thinking just about the skill.
Well, yeah, but there are certain rudimentary things that most people don't know about. I mean, people were looking at fabric samples that were 6 inches by 6 inches. Well, you can't do that. you have to see what the real scale of the fabric is. So I did teach them scale and color.
Okay, but this stuff is skill. These are skills that you can... This is not the same as what you have, which is the capacity to see the whole. And I mean, my own feeling would be that that's very difficult to give away, that that's somehow part of you that other people don't have.
Well, I have to assume they don't, because that was the business.
Right.
To go and do it for them.
Right. Yeah.
And it wasn't just that they had a lot of money. Some of them didn't. But they just really were stumped.
Well, I am. I take almost nothing in through my eyes. I mean, I'm not visual at all.
Well, Dick is like that.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it's all auditory for me. So, again, these are things that we are either born with or early on develop capacities for or compensate for or whatever, but I don't think you can give that stuff away. So,
well, I think I gave it to one of my kids.
Well, I didn't mean that, right?
No, no. I'm teasing because my son is an art director.
Yeah.
And he's extremely talented.
Well, yeah.
He sees in three dimensions.
He got it.
And
he's got the gene.
Does.
Yeah.
He's got the gene.
Wow, that's terrific.
And his wife has the gene.
Wow.
Yes. They both went to RISD, and she sees everything in its entirety. We get along great.
That's so wonderful. So you are sculpting now and have been doing for
a long time. Every day.
Yeah. When did this start? This phase?
Well, and life is luck as well as skill. When we moved to Florida, I was introduced to a guy who was working in a group of sculptors up in Osprey, right on the water.
Mm.
And he invited me to see what they did, and then they invited me to join them. They were a loosely knit group working there. And at that point, I was working in clay. I realized that if I ever wanted to really learn stone properly, these guys would have the knowledge of the tools. And so I learned to work with power tools. And that changed my life. I gave up my business, or I should say I let it peter out. And I joined this group, and we moved around like gypsies for a few years, and then I got my own studio. And this guy, his name is Fred, is still working with me.
So tell me what you do.
Well, I work in wood and different kinds of stone, marble and alabaster.
Mm.
And sometimes African Wonderstone, which is black. And I have a schedule where I work every Tuesday and Thursday till noon. And then I fit in during the rest of the week whatever I can. And I've had some pretty big shows, which is nice. And I've sold quite a bit of sculpture, which I find very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I like to know somebody's looking at it and enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I know it's alive, especially when you bump into somebody and they say, I stroke that piece every day. Yeah. And so that's what I do. That's what my life is now.
Yeah.
It's my paradise.
It's what you got what you wanted.
I got what I wanted, and I didn't even know what I wanted. Yes, I did. I went to Italy in 1975, and I visited sculpture friends from the Art Students League. And I was extremely envious of the setup, and they offered a studio to me if I wanted to move there.
Oh.
And helping hands to lift the stone, because it's pretty heavy. And of course, I had another life back here, which I came back to, but it was always in the back of my head to live like that. And I can live like that in Venice.
Wow.
I'm not saying it's as beautiful as Tuscany, but it's pretty close.
I'm thinking that, in a way, you've come full circle from what you had started out with.
You mean the jigsaw puzzles?
Yeah.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I have to tell you something that you don't know about.
Uh-huh.
I have been making something I call wood mosaics, and they're jigsaw puzzles. The only difference, and the pieces fit together, and the only difference is that I sculpt the tops of the pieces.
I'll show them to you. Yeah, I want to.
I go from low to high and high to low, and I glue them to a backing, and then I take a blowtorch and I burnish them. And I'm making jigsaw.
Yeah, so you literally.
That is literally.
Literally, that's amazing.
Okay. Yes, and when I'm doing it, and you as a psychologist would appreciate this, I'm almost a little girl again, excepting I'm careful with the saw. I use an electric saw. But it's very, for me, it's playful. It's very childlike, almost. It's so obvious to me. And I make the design on tracing paper, and I use old-fashioned carbon paper, which, by the way, is hard to find, typing paper. And I trace it onto the wood. I mean, it's very simple stuff, very inexpensive to do. I do it in pine, and they're good.
Yeah, and I can hear the compelling benefits. It's not really enough of a word, benefit, mm-hmm. of being captured by an art, is that it compels you, that you melt into it, you're immersed in it, and it's just you and the thing.
Well, the marvel for me is that there's no client involved. I mean, I love all of you clients out there, but to not have to answer to anyone is wonderful.
Right. And just to do what...
When I feel like it.
Right. Well, not only when you feel like it, but what your psyche dictates, what your fingers do, what your mind is envisioning. It's you in the piece.
Hmm? Well, I think that the essence of life, if possible, is to love to get up in the morning and do what you like to do. And I don't care whether it's gardening or painting furniture or even shopping, but if you really burn to do it, it's a wonderful feeling.
I couldn't agree more. And I do think that as a culture, we don't really encourage that. We encourage you to find something that you can do to make a living or to do whatever it is that you're supposed to do, but we don't really emphasize the significance, the importance of what Joseph Campbell would say, you know, to follow your bliss.
Follow your bliss. Mm-hmm. Well, when I look back on childhood and puzzles, and I can hear my mother saying, "Why are you wasting your time doing that?" I got a funny one for you. I was about 14 years old when the war broke out, and I had at least 800 puzzles. I mean, they were stacked up in the attic, and they were tied together, and I decided to make each one and mark on it how many pieces were missing. And I gave it to the USO. All the puzzles.
And you marked on
maybe there were 400.
How many pieces were missing so that they wouldn't think that they had
lost them. Right, because I knew I had lost pieces.
Oh, my gosh.
Or I had gotten puzzles that were incomplete. But that's what I did. And I have only one puzzle. This is how crazy it is. I have one puzzle that I wish I had saved. And it wasn't a particularly hard one. But it had lace, and I loved putting it together because I'd make them more than once.
So this is—it's the same thing. It's the—it's the putting of things together that turns you on.
Absolutely,
it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And not only that you found an art form that allows for putting things together.
That's the luck.
Well, no, I don't think it is. No, I don't. I think. Well, forgive me. I mean, this is my own opinion, but I think that some people are able, for reasons that I'm not going to go into now, to trust their unconscious. And that if you trust your unconscious leads you to the things that fit you. And you absolutely did that over and over again. Never mind that your mother said, you know, why are you wasting your time? Never mind that you had to do something to make a living. You made it always. You unerringly were drawn to those things that used that aspect of yourself.
But you know, unfortunately, I always thought that I was doing it because there was nothing else I knew how to do.
That's another thing altogether.
Well, I realized that, but I kept saying, well, this I can do, and I can do very well, and I can, you know, get the applause I need and the money and so on. But it was not just because I liked to do that. It was because I didn't know what else to do.
Well, let me tell you that I was on a stage at 3 singing. I was singing long before I was 3, I was singing. And when I was old enough to think about what I would do for a living, it never occurred to me to sing because it was too easy.
You've got it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got it.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Somehow, and I'm not sure whether that's something our family does to us or something the culture does to us.
Both.
Right.
Yeah.
And You know, if these interviews that I'm doing with artists, this hadn't occurred to me before, but if anyone is able to hear these and validate their own urge to art in whatever form, that would be a terrific gift to me. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
That tears in my eyes.
yes. It is, again, it's wonderful to wake up in the morning and burn to do what you love to do.
Yes. And you deserve it.
No, I want it.
No. Actually, I wasn't talking to you.
Oh, okay.
I was talking to whoever is listening,
okay,
who doesn't know it.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Yes.
That it's not frivolous.
No.
It's essential.
No, even if you have to do it alongside your daily bread.
That's right.
As
aside from your day gig.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, if I had to work now, I would work, and then I'd come home and I would nap or something and go across the street and sculpt.
Yes.
Yeah.
And having found something that does that for you, there's really nothing like it.
I'll tell you the other interesting part. I used to worry when I was first with a group that after I finished a piece that I wouldn't have another idea. And at first it worried me, and now I know that when the next stone makes its way to the studio, I know what to do.
I have often thought, this is the last song I'll write.
Well, that's the same feeling. Mm-hmm. Am I going to think of something else?
Right.
Yeah.
And again, for me, this is really all about trusting our unconscious, knowing that our unconscious is inexhaustible.
And working all the time.
And working all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I sometimes think it's cooking back there, and then some day or morning or whatever, it'll come to the forehead and spill out, and I'll know what I have to do.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's a really accurate analogy or metaphor,
mm-hmm,
because I know that, you know, more and more in my own life, I have trusted that what I need to know, I will know when it's right to know it, and I don't have to worry so much about it.
I'm with you.
I know you are.
Yeah.
Are you having a show in the near future that
finished a show, which was called Touch, and anyone who saw the show could touch, but it was geared to the Lighthouse for the Blind. And I was lucky enough to have a day, or I should say they arranged a day, and they brought a dozen or so people who were studying what they needed to know in order to survive when their sight was completely gone. No one was completely blind, but some of them had canes and special glasses. It was probably mostly macular degeneration. Mm-hmm. And I had a thrill because they spoke about how they felt about touching the sculpture and what they saw through their hands. And I have the experience, don't cry, I have had the experience, and I did this up in New York too a few years ago, that when I think I'm finished with a piece, meaning before I polish it and refine it, I close my eyes and I spend a good few minutes touching every part of it, not for smoothness, but whether it's deep enough or round enough. I can tell better with my fingers than I can with my eyes. Mm-hmm. So I knew that they could enjoy it. And I'm putting together a DVD right now of that day when they came to see touch. And they all talked about seeing, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Is it going to be for sale, the DVD?
No, I'm doing it mostly to send to other lighthouses to see if they'd like to put it on.
Very nice. Yeah. Well, this is wonderful. You're the first, you may be the only sculptor that I get to talk to. A number of musicians and a couple of actors. This is very different. I mean, it has its similarities because anybody who's captured by an art is captured by an art, but this is very different. And thank you very much.
And thank you very much.
So that was the lovely, talented, charming Julia Hyman, who followed her lovely, talented, charming husband, Dick. It seems to me that the more talented the people I talk to, the more generous and kind they are. One thing I want to be sure to have said before the show is over is if you have any interest in sculpture at all you want to go up on Julia Hyman's website. Her work is absolutely beautiful. And you can see it on her website, which is, of course, www.juliahyman.com. Okay, so there's just enough time for me to say thank you for listening. Next week, I'll be here, and I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unsafe.